I'm Bruce Barber, and this is Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally known expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist and the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. He specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to submit a question about cancer, please email us at canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can call 1-888-234-4YCC. If you'd like to listen to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers, each segment is posted on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. This evening, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will be talking about life after cancer with Dr. Ruth McCorkle, the Florence Wald Professor of Nursing, and Dr. Tish Knopf, the American Cancer Society Professor of Oncology Nursing at the Yale School of Nursing.
Tish, let's start out by talking about what happens emotionally when a patient finishes treatment.
Well, I think all the transitions, you know, before diagnosis, waiting for treatment, and end of treatment are difficult times. And so the end of treatment, patients, you know, they felt pretty secure getting their treatment. Mm-hmm. So at the end of treatment, they're uncertain. They feel sort of vulnerable. The treatment's been keeping the cancer away. They get anxious and, you know, they've had all the support of the healthcare providers. So they also feel a little bit of a sense of abandonment. Like, you know, I've been coming here every week, every 2 weeks, and now, you know, I'll see you in 3 months. So it's a little bit of a scary time for patients sure. when they end treatment.
Do you get a sense that most people vocalize that, or that it's more of a sort of an internal feeling that they have of just not feeling quite right?
I think it's probably an internal feeling. Mm. I think it may come out in support groups when patients talk about it. And I don't think it's something we particularly address at the last treatment. You know, they still have some physical side effects, and so you tend to focus in on symptom management, and I think the psychological issues start to surface, really, not until after they go home another month, 2 months, and then I think the whole impact of the diagnosis and the treatment begins to settle in.
It is interesting because it does seem to me that patients and their families view the clinic setting and the doctors, the nurses, all the support staff as really kind of their home away from home. It's become like a family environment for them. And then I guess that's what makes it so difficult, right, once treatment's ending.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the fear of recurrence when you're actively getting treatment and you're seeing other patients and you're seeing your nurse and you're seeing your doctor, there's a great sense of I'm doing something to keep this away. So I think it is a very supportive environment when you're in the clinical situation.
Ruth, I want to talk about families some also because cancer is very, very hard on the whole family. What are some of your observations about, again, when treatment is finished, what is the process for a family?
Well, it's equally hard on families, especially if there's children involved. But what's interesting is the research really shows that as the patient gets better, family members often get even more burden because they're the ones that sort of have to take on the roles until the family gets back to be 100%, the patient gets back to be 100%. And so they often are the ones doing all of the transportation of children or the grocery shopping. And some of these things are role reversal, and they are things that they haven't socialized in their family to be doing. So not only do they have to do their own work, but they have to pick up the slack. And so it becomes very difficult for them. And they also go through these sort of existential crises, either when the disease or the treatment changes, in which there are changes in the person with the cancer. So they are always worried about their future. Are they going to have a future with that person and what their life's going to be like?
Let me ask you a little bit more about the role reversal. Can you give me an example?
Well, often someone, if it's a woman in the family who is on chemotherapy and she's mainly been responsible for cooking the meals, when you're taking chemotherapy, food may really not look very good and taste very good. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult to prepare the food. So the husband may have to take that on, or an older daughter, often that'll happen. Yep. So it becomes very difficult.
So, Ken, it's interesting. Following up on what Ruth was just talking about, you yourself actually went through this a number of years ago.
Right.
For those listeners who haven't maybe tuned in before to the show, Maybe we can just say that your wife many years ago had acute leukemia. Yep. Thank God she's doing great.
Yep.
But in fact, you actually also experienced this role reversal, if you will.
Well, it's true. In a sense, that's why I asked you about it. So I did, yes, I did a lot of cooking, which I really hadn't done before. And I have to tell you, my family, though I love them, they were merciless. I mean, they were so critical of my cooking. But I did the best I could. But you know what? I'll make an observation, and then I'd love to get your reactions. My wife, thank God, eventually got better and came back to doing all, you know, the normal activities. But that was a period of readjustment because there were a number of things. I was both the father and the mother and doing all and sort of being responsible for her. Well, then she wants to be responsible for herself, and she wanted to get back into her regular activities, and it was difficult. So what kind of, what's your observation? And what would be your suggestions to other people who might notice that?
Well, I think the family and the spouse or sister, whoever is helping the person, really have to prioritize what they want to do. If the person really wants to go back to work, that person may then need these helps in the family. But if they want to take their roles on, so you just have to realize you're not going to be 100%. Mm-hmm. And you have to decide what is the most important and who's going to help you the most. And so it's a balance.
Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing is trying to help patients identify communication resources and who they communicate with and how they communicate, both, I think, healthcare providers and their family, especially husbands and wives or patients and their partners. If there's not a good open communication, I think the difficulty in the emotional distress and the physical recovery and changing of roles becomes all that much more difficult. So that it's very well documented in the literature that typically, as patients recover from their physical side effects, like from fatigue and their hair grows back in, the emotional distress and the fear of recurrence doesn't go away, but the family wants the patient to be better.
Yeah,
so they
yeah.
look better, you know, their hair's back, their energy's back, but psychologically they're not really fully recovered, and yet the family doesn't want to talk about it anymore. You know what? You got your treatment, get on with life. So I think, you know, as healthcare providers to try and get that message to patients about openly talking about it so everybody is, you know, somewhat on the same page in terms of the recovery.
And yet that sometimes can be very, very difficult, right, to have open communication amongst family members and loved ones. And so if there are difficulties with respect to those open lines of communication, do you have any suggestions, Tish, as to what patients and families can, you know, seek help or whatever?
Well, I think there are a lot of options. I think most clinical settings have nurses or social workers that can provide some one-on-one kind of counseling. I think the internet is a great resource for a variety of patients. There's all kinds of different support services through organizations like Cancer Care or the American Cancer Society or the National Cancer Institute. And then there are support groups. And, you know, and I think not all patients like the group environment. So there's also, I think, with good assessment and referrals for psychotherapy on one-to-one basis, I think is appropriate in a lot of cases. We know that families that were not perfect, I mean, no family is, but families who didn't do really well as a family before a cancer diagnosis tend to be the ones that don't do well after. And I think sometimes helping families who may look a little more at risk for doing well is a good thing that nurses and doctors can help out with.
Along those lines, I mean, you know, for care providers, is there anything that the research shows us about how we can identify families or patients that are at higher risk? And along those lines, for the audience as well, what things going into the cancer experience may predict that this is going to be rougher or perhaps easier for them?
Well, one of the things that's coming out right now in September is a new report by the Institute of Medicine on the psychosocial needs of patients and families. And one of the recommendations of that is screening. Not only do you want to screen your patients, but you would like to screen your families if they look at risk. Mm-hmm. And so it's an easy tool. It's an emotional distress thermometer that goes from 0 to 10. And if you score 4 on the thermometer, cancer, they recommend that you get evaluated by a psychological healthcare provider, like a social worker or a nurse that's trained in those specialties.
So I guess potentially an intervention early on with a social worker, a nurse, a caring nurse, or other care providers will make a difference. Is that your thought?
I think probably the most important thing for patients and families to hear is that the reactions they're having are common among all patients. What's troublesome is whether the reaction is sustained. And if it goes on for a long time and starts interfering with your sleep and your ability to function, then you really need to get some assistance to help you with it.
Tish, along those lines, depression or anxiety, what would be considered sort of, I mean, not normal, but common? And at what point might you start to say to yourself, this is beyond what we're comfortable with? We think it's a problem.
Well, I think, first of all, one red flag is, does the patient have a history of depression or any kind of psychological distress before? Because they are at higher risk for depression after that. But I think a basic assessment tool like the distress thermometer at least gives you some idea, is this above just being irritable, feeling sad? I mean, those are normative reactions. Mm-hmm. For the majority of patients and families. But then if patients are really having a hard time getting up and going to work every day, I think then we need a psychiatrist or a psychologist who could do a better assessment and intervene with these patients.
Ruth, we've been talking a lot about the kind of psycho-emotional consequences. Maybe you could discuss a little bit more some of the physical consequences that patients may have to deal with once they've completed their treatment?
Well, the number one problem for patients is fatigue. I mean, it's just enormously prevalent. I'm a breast cancer survivor of 17 years, and some of the research talks about you being bone tired. I mean, really just wiped out. And one of the things that actually Tish is doing is something to help that, and she's found that exercise, just walking every day, even though you don't feel like it, really does stimulate those endorphins and get you going and feeling a little better. But fatigue then affects your sleep, affects your appetite. It seems that there's a group of symptoms that hang together. And so if it's really the basis of fatigue, then if you do these simple interventions of walking, sometimes you can feel better about that.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to us at yalecanceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about life after cancer with Dr. Ruth McCorkle and Dr. Tish Knopf from the Yale Cancer Center.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2007, there will be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country. 2,400 patients are diagnosed every year in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths, and when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope, and clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, a federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. For more information, go to yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our two guests, Dr. Ruth McCorkle and Dr. Tish Knopf, discussing cancer survivorship.
But before the break, Ruth, we were talking about the physical consequences of what patients with cancer have to face after treatment, and you were talking about fatigue as being a very big issue. You know, what other physical issues might a cancer survivor have to deal with?
Well, what's interesting is a lot of people fear pain. And other than the pain associated with surgery, because most people have some kind of biopsy, or especially if they have a solid tumor, there's a little pain associated with that. But most cancers really aren't painful. And so pain is sort of, if you do have pain with cancers, and some of them can metastasize to the bone, spread to the bone. So that's a good warning sign. Mm-hmm. So you should be seeking help if you experience pain. But it's mostly nausea, some lack of appetite, fatigue, and insomnia. Sleep disturbances are the common ones. That also there's some hormonal imbalances. In my own experience, I also was thrown into menopause early. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. having the hot flashes, and it's very disconcerting when you are experiencing this personally. And so when you're in the middle of this, it's so difficult to talk to your family about it. And because you're trying to take care of yourself, and if you're a mother and have to take care of your children too, it just drains you more. And then you become, and if you work and you're not going to work and you're dependent on your income, it just escalates between the physical and the mental.
And there's also this issue of chemo brain. Maybe you can explain to our listeners what that means.
Well, sometimes the chemotherapy has a side effect of interfering with your ability to think, and it's problematic because at the same time, people are giving you information, make decisions about your treatment, what kinds of treatment, and during this time, and it's bombarded also with the fatigue. But Tisch is also doing a cognitive study around chemo brain, and there is association with some hormones. So maybe she could mm-hmm. tell us about that.
Yeah, we think that the major problems that patients complain about are being able to pay attention to what they're doing, being able to concentrate, and forgetfulness. Forgetfulness is probably the single symptom that most patients complain about. And at least in the breast cancer population, we think that, you know, as Ruth described, being thrown into menopause, the abrupt menopause may in fact be contributing to some of these memory and attention problems. And we're hoping that we're going to be able to get some information to be able to look at this, because these symptoms are really scary for mm-hmm. patients. And the more information we have that can explain why they are forgetting and techniques to actually improve that. There are now several interventions that are trying to look at ways to maybe not necessarily improve memory, but sort of compensate for it, you know, making some very common sense things, making lists, keeping a calendar. And some of these changes have been reported as particularly distressful in the work environment, more so than in the home, and being able to perform at the same level.
Just along those lines, can you tell us a little bit about what the research shows on exercise for cancer survivors?
Now there is really a lot of research on exercise. There's no question that exercise improves physical functioning. I mean, the majority of patients get what we call deconditioned during treatment because they decrease their level of physical activity, and then it becomes a vicious cycle with a fatigue of less activity. You know, anybody who's had the flu and has spent 2 days in bed, you know, your energy level is not the same on the third day. So it improves physical functioning and improves psychological well-being. It improves muscle strength. It improves the patient's outlook. And now one of the studies that we're trying to do and look at is, can it improve some of the potential late effects like bone loss from being induced into menopause or from some of our cancer treatments? And so I'm going to be looking at resistance exercise and see if resistance exercise can actually prevent women from losing bone and also maintaining weight, because we know that obesity and overweight is a risk factor for some cancers and increased risk of recurrence. So if we can maintain a healthy lifetime weight, that's also going to decrease a patient's risk for not only cancer, but diabetes and heart disease.
And Tish, with respect to exercise and physical activity, you know, what amount, what intensity level is required in order for, you know, a cancer survivor to be able to continue to, you know, move forward?
Well, I think we should be following the national recommendations, and that is that everyone, every adult ought to be moderate exercise described as at least 30 minutes of, say, brisk walking on most days of the week. And there have been two studies with breast cancer and colon cancer patients that have suggested that walking at those recommended levels actually are associated with a decreased risk of recurrence and survival. So the minimum requirement or the minimal recommendation is 30 minutes of moderate activity on most days of the week.
Ruth, I wanted to ask you, perhaps based on your own personal experience, but you had cancer, I guess, many years ago. How's that experience changed you as you sort of look at the long term?
Well, I initially thought it was a huge interruption in my life because my treatment lasted about 9 months with my chemotherapy and radiation. And it was a rough time because I had small children. They were 7 and 8 at the time. So I was fortunate because I was able to get childcare and transportation, other things. But at the time, you are just sort of in limbo. But once I got through the treatment and maybe about a year later, I realized how very lucky I was in my early diagnosis and early stage, and that it sort of gave me a new release on life. Mm-hmm. And it made me start changing my priorities and really enjoying my family more. And setting goals. But I also, Gilda Radner, in one of her books, said you really have to be a cancer survivor to help people. Mm-hmm. And I always took offense at that early on when I read that and was teaching students. But after you have this experience, it really does make you humble and gives you great insight to the struggles that some patients experience.
You know, as you look at you know, your own research, your own personal experience, you know, is there a lot of resiliency in cancer survivors?
Oh, they're phenomenal. The courage and efforts that they make. I mean, every day that I walk through the clinics and you see the people and getting there and they slug it out and they're doing a terrific job, and just people recognizing what a good job they're doing, getting themselves in, getting through each day, mm-hmm. and getting on the other side of it. It's worth it.
And again, it's true, I think, not only for the patient, him or herself, but also for the caregivers and the loved ones who've all really been part of the treatment aspects and then the recovery period.
Yeah, and to make them understand that they're all part of the team to help get the person well and that they've played a role. I know it's critically important to have children understand that they're helping their mother, their father, their brother and during this time, and that this is going to help to make them better.
I mean, in many ways, then, it can be really a strengthening experience for a family also.
Oh, absolutely.
I have a question for either one or both of you, but it's not uncommon to see a patient who had cancer 10, 15 years ago and to ask them, you know, they'll say, oh, I had breast cancer, I had colon cancer. And, you know, we might ask in a non-medical way, what stage was it and what treatment did you have? And they really don't know anything about it. So what are some ways that we can share that information with patients so that they have the information, which hopefully is empowering?
Well, I think one of the recommendations now, and it certainly makes sense, is to provide the patient with a summary of the treatment they got when their treatment is completed. So they actually have a personal history of what their diagnosis was, what the stage was, and what the treatment was. And then also that will help them in follow-up care understand why they need certain tests or to look out for maybe a long-term effect of treatment that may occur 10 or 15 years later. And I think having the information decreases that sense of uncertainty and a lot of the fears that patients have, I think, can really be decreased by providing them with accurate information.
In fact, I think a great deal of interest right now is being focused on developing these cancer survivorship clinics to really address the issue that you just highlighted, Ken.
Yeah, and I'll just share that. I mean, we do have the, here at Yale, the Connecticut Challenge Cancer Survivorship Program. It's one of, probably about 13 or 14 survivorship programs in the country, and really an emphasis on a holistic approach. Each patient sees a nurse practitioner or doctor, as well as a physical therapist, nutritionist, and a social worker, so to try to address some of these issues. Ruth, what's been, you've been at several of the major universities that have programs. What have you seen as their contribution?
Well, the survivorship programs actually started in the pediatric area, and they've done a terrific job, St. Jude. And we have a Heroes Clinic here at Yale and run by Nina Caden and Sheila Santa Croce, and they do a fantastic job. I mean, they do such a good job. The people that were young that now are older don't want to leave the clinic. I think the oldest patient in the clinic is 40. So when you think about pediatrics, so it just shows you what a good job they do. But now we've transported that into the adult population. Actually, Anna Meadows, who started at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, was on the panel that really earmarked this at the National Cancer Institute, and it sort of broke loose like a dam with the floodwaters that there are so many survivors, over 10 million survivors now. So it's long overdue, and it's exciting that we're a part of that in the state. I think the citizens of Connecticut, even our governor, I mean, all of us are cancer survivors. It's so prevalent that I think it's a very good thing.
I have to say, actually, just exciting the number of the growing number of cancer survivors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, really, it's a testimony to many things, including medicine, and also again the strength of people getting through this. Well, we'd like to I'd like to thank Dr. Ruth McCorkle and Dr. Tishnoff for joining us at Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Yeah, Ruth and Tish, this has been great, and we look forward to having you both come back for a future show. Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we'll discuss ovarian cancer with Dr. Thomas Rutherford.